Into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot. Don't shoot! Oh, what a goal for Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah.
No. Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your App Store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network. With Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.
Football. On Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise. The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Welcome along. Latest in the Champions League. Second half's just getting underway. Manchester City with the only game, or the only goal rather, in both games. Man City 1-0 up away to Borussia Mönchengladbach. Bernardo Silva with the goal for City in the first half. It is nil all between Atalanta and Real Madrid. Earlier on in the Europa League round of 32, Spurs booked their place in the round of 16. 4-0 winners at home to Wolfsburg. Got a busy football show for you later on. Tim Vickery, always a welcome guest, will be talking to us about the new Pelé documentary, which is available on Netflix. If you've seen it, fire in any thoughts. 53106, you'll get us at Off the Ball on Twitter. But first, we are talking Celtic. We have with us Paul John Dykes, author and host of a Celtic State of Mind podcast. Paul John, you're very welcome.
Thanks for inviting me on. It's an absolute pleasure.
What has been the Celtic state of mind all year? Miserable, horrified, disgusted, angry? Nothing good, I suspect.
All of the above and a little bit more as well. We were entering a season where we felt that history would be made. And all season, month on month, has been a catastrophe followed by an even bigger catastrophe. So today's news, obviously, is basically the final part of that sorry affair. We feel it was something that should have happened a while ago.
And Paul John, on your podcast or in various Celtic forums or however you could all communicate in this pandemic situation, were there inklings or were there worries as the season was beginning that this, 10 in a row season was going to go awry? Or was everybody feeling pretty okay about things?
I think the majority of people were feeling fairly confident without being too bullish or complacent about it. I mean, if you go further back, you know, the Green Brigade had unleashed various banners at the ground to warn the board not to fall asleep at the wheel. And at that time, you know, I feel that that feeling was part of a minority group. But as the season went on, more and more people began to look back on the way that we had been recruiting players, the way that we had allowed Brendan Rodgers to leave the club, and even Neil Lennon's appointment, you know. But again, this is all with hindsight. You go back to the summer after what looked like a very positive transfer window, and many, many Celtic fans, I feel, were rightfully confident going into this season.
Okay, so it's a double whammy. You didn't even see this thing coming.
We didn't. And again, we always expect the board to see it coming. We expect the powers at the club to see it coming. But as fans, you know, we were just trying to stabilise ourselves, knowing that for part of the season, we felt we wouldn't be in the stadium. We didn't realise it would be for the entire season. But, very quickly indeed, it became clear that something was just not right at Celtic Park way back in August. Mm. After every big defeat, a group of fans, like someone, myself, a Celtic State of Mind, other podcast, would come out and speak about a change being needed. Some people thought that was knee-jerk, but as the season went on, more and more people started feeling the same.
Has there been a consistency to the performances? But when I say a consistency to the performances, I mean what's wrong with them? Like, is there just a fairly galling issue for Celtic on the field, or is it a whole spectrum of different things going wrong at different times?
Well, there definitely is a spectrum of issues all around the club. But as fans watching on the park, the team playing with absolutely no tempo, no shape, no imagination, and strangely for Celtic, a lack of fitness.
Right.
A huge amount of goals that we've conceded this season have been after the 70th minute. And that's unusual for Celtic. So you look at the squad, We kept all the star players. We didn't sell anyone off in the summer. We brought in six new players. We felt we were strengthening the squad. Of course, Shane Duffy was one of those players. But, you know, it didn't click, and it hasn't clicked all season. You could go right back to the Ferencváros game in the Champions League, the first game against Rangers when we were well beaten. We didn't even have a shot at goal that day. And that was early in the season. And it just got, it went from bad to worse.
Which brings us to Neil Lennon then. So defeat to Ross County on Sunday left them 18 points behind Rangers, and Lennon has announced his resignation. How culpable is he in all of this, do you feel?
Hugely. I mean, it is a joint responsibility, and we keep saying this. There's an issue around recruitment. And interestingly enough, Brendan Rodgers came out today and spoke about the new manager will require autonomy when it comes to selecting his staff and his players.
Right.
I don't think Neil Lennon's had that. He didn't assemble his own coaching staff, and he didn't get his first choice of player. So we know that he was interested in Fraser Foster. We lost out. He wanted Ivan Toney. We lost out on him as well. We brought in Barkas and Ayeti for £10 million worth of new signings, and they haven't worked out. So Neil Lennon has to work with what he's got. I mean, he's got a talented squad. This is a frustration. Edouard, Christie, McGregor, Ayer at the back, Julien before he got injured. We've got a talented squad. He failed to play David Turnbull right through to the latter end of 2020. Turnbull's come in and been an absolute revelation. So the question would be, why didn't we play him earlier? We needed his creativity. And that was down to Lennon.
When I think of Brendan Rodgers, I mean, and increasingly it's easy to do so given how things are going at Leicester, you think of a tactically astute coach, forward-thinking, a well-drilled outfit. When I think of Lennon, and please correct me if I'm wrong here, so I'm talking here in generalities and perception, but I would see more of an old-school coach, you know, of the Martin O'Neill school of, look, you're all players, go out there and do it, figure it out yourselves, you know, be men out there, and maybe in the modern era, that's less and less effective. So is that a fair observation of Lennon? I mean, you're watching them week in, week out. Would that be a complaint of Lennon's management?
100%.
Yeah.
And we could actually look at the first tenure under Neil Lennon compared to this one. Someone on the podcast last week said he's an analog manager in a digital football world. And I think that is the way to describe Neil Lennon. So first time round, we had a player up front called Anthony Stokes. You'll be aware of Tony Stokes. Now, if Neil Lennon shouts and screams at Anthony Stokes in the dressing room, he'll get a response from him, and he often did. If he tries that with Odson Edouard straight out of the PSG academy, Odson Edouard will down tools and won't try a leg, and that's exactly what's happened. Some of his ex-players, so Marvin Bartley at Hibs, Kelvin Wilson and Joe Ledley at Celtic, have all recently come out and said that Neil Lennon did not place too much emphasis on tactics. And in 2020-21, that is suicide, because we've got a management team, albeit an inexperienced team at Rangers, who are led by Steven Gerrard, but we have Michael Beale and Gary McAllister in there as well. And they figured out very quickly how to play Celtic, and that was key.
Which brings us to his replacement, I suppose. John Kennedy will take charge of the team for now. Is he likely to have any chance of getting the job on a full-time basis?
I think we're in a similar situation than we were back in 2010 when Neil Lennon got the job first time round. He's got 8 games. I think it was 9 back in Neil's time. So John Kennedy's got 8 games. He's a highly rated coach. He's worked under Ronnie Dyla, Brendan Rodgers and Neil Lennon. But Celtic fans want a wholesale change. So when Neil Lennon stepped down today and it was announced this morning that he had resigned, Celtic fans wanted the entire coaching staff to follow him. Because if you think about it, you know, John Kennedy and Gavin Strachan are working with those players day to day on the training grounds. Obviously, Neil Lennon's a manager. He picks the team. He gives the team talk. He makes the decisions at the side of the park. But John Kennedy is also culpable. So I think even though he is one of the front runners when it comes down to the odds of replacing Neil Lennon permanently, it would not be a popular decision.
Yeah. So even if they were to grind out, you know, 7 1-0 wins and a D decent result and a draw, and that, you know, on the face of it, is a decent effort across nine games, it mightn't bode so well for the future in reality.
I don't think so. And, you know, I might be doing an injustice to John Kennedy. He's been at the club, believe it or not, for 30 years. He's only 37. He's only 37 years of age.
Right.
And, you know, Damien Duff said upon his departure from Celtic that he rated John Kennedy as one of the best coaches he had ever worked with. So that's high praise indeed.
Mm.
But as I say, it's guilty by association. He's been part of this downfall, this campaign. And I hope that it's only a temporary measure to have John Kennedy in place.
The names I'm seeing bandied about include Eddie Howe, Rafa Benitez, I've seen Roberto Martinez's name. Haven't seen Roy Keane's name, actually. I would have thought that's an easy headline even. You know, you would just think, well, let's just throw Roy Keane's name on a headline and we'll get lots of clicks or we'll sell a few papers. I haven't seen Keane's name mentioned in relation to the job. I mean, he would be perceived as also of the Martin O'Neill era for obvious reasons.
He would. I think recently, former midfielder Stylian Petrov did give Roy Keane a shout out. Again, I can see how that's kind of received on the podcast because we've got a live and interactive section of that. And again, you know, maybe surprising to some, it wouldn't be a popular choice. People do look at Roy Keane in the same kind of mould as Martin O'Neill. He's obviously worked with him at various jobs. But again, if you look at Keane's managerial record, he's only managed 151 games. And I think only one season was in the top flight in England. So, you know, Celtic fans are looking at, you know, managers like Eddie Howe. Rafa Benitez has been mentioned. And as have Roberto Martinez and Sean Maloney. Now, these are top-end managers. And, you know, they're also, I'm sure, going to be chased by some of the clubs down south. So what I will say is whatever the appointment is will indicate to the Celtic support the level of ambition of the new board and the CEO who's coming in the summer.
What's the financial situation at the club?
Well, we recently announced our half-term results, our interim results, and Celtic had lost a great sum of money. You know, we were basically £12 million down, a loss of £6 million. So we are stable in terms of Scottish football. I mean, the clubs throughout the game are going to be in a dire, dire situation. Celtic were in a good position before we went into the pandemic. 57,000 fans bought season tickets knowing we wouldn't be there throughout the season. So we will survive this, but we will have to look at the recruitment because we can't afford to be throwing £5 million at Greek goalkeepers who don't play.
Yeah. So you say Celtic sold, did you say 57,000 season tickets at the start of this season?
We did, yeah, 57. We were able to sell a few thousand more in the knowledge that we wouldn't actually be in the ground. So the maximum was 57 and we sold out. Now, the club are actually going to be asking the season tickets to renew in the coming weeks. We would expect that at some point in March normally. And I think the announcement today was part of a charm offensive because the club really need to keep the supporters on side.
Mm. So certainly a healthy quotient of those 57,000 were in effect just charitable donations to the club from fans.
Yeah, they were. And, you know, what we got in return was a virtual season ticket. We got a pass to Celtic TV. It wasn't great. I was getting text messages if someone was watching it on another broadcaster because they were getting the game live and, you know, we were 7 or 8 seconds behind. So it's not been a great season, but Celtic fans realised the magnitude of this season, the fact that it was 10 in a row. So you're right, it was really donations, but the club are now being faced with, I'm not going to say a rabid fan base, but questions have been asked, protests have taken place outside the ground already this season. And I think the departure of Peter Lowell, first and foremost, followed by Neil Lennon, are two ways closer to trying to get the fan base back on board. But again, a lot of that's going to hinge on who will be the manager.
As for the playing base, I've seen the accusation made that a number of the players down tools. You mentioned the striker. Has that happened? And who would that be aimed at? Like, how many players, if I was to ask an average Celtic fan, do they reckon of down tools?
You know what? That comes from comments made by Neil Lennon after we were knocked out of the Champions League. And he came out and said that there are players in that dressing room who don't want to be at the club. So Neil Lennon came out and said that. And I think the reason he did it was to try and get a reaction. I think he was playing mind games. He's always been known as a motivator. But you know this, it backfired.
Right.
So the types of players you're looking at are Olivier Ntcham, who's gone out to Marseille on loan. Jeremy Frimpong, who has been transferred to Bayer Leverkusen. Odson Edouard, who is our game changer. He's the man who can turn a game on its head. Ryan Christie, who wants to move down south. And finally, Chris Iyer. And out of that bunch of players, the one guy who's never let us down this season has been Chris Iyer. I mean, he's had interest from AC Milan. He's going to go to the very top, but he's not allowed his the disharmony within the dressing room to affect his performances.
Mm. In the short term, of course, there is the prospect of Rangers being able to clinch the title at Parkhead on March 21st. I presume you'd all rather avoid that.
That is the worst case scenario. And I remember the last time that happened, in actual fact.
Yeah.
It's one of these things that I know certainly Rangers fans would look forward to that. But the magnitude again of that, it really is rubbing our nose in it. And also it's a reminder, it's a stark reminder that, you know, the pendulum of domination has swung back and forth in Glasgow for generations. We're watching it swing away from Celtic Park in the cruelest possible fashion. It would all happen at our own patch. So we hope it doesn't happen. Rangers have not been beaten domestically this season in the league. They don't actually look as though they will be beaten. So that's something that we won't be looking forward to.
Mm. How big a deal has the 10 in a row thing been?
It's been massive. It's been all-encompassing. We've been speaking about it since 2013, 2014. You know, people were selling merchandise this year saying that it's going to be 10 in a row. Had, obviously, we'd been in the grounds, that would have been the chant all season. But you know what? It might have actually been one of the main reasons for us capitulating. We have been so focused on domestic domination that we have been happy to be just one step ahead of the competition. Mm. And across the city, Steven Gerrard has built a unit. He's built a very competent side. And they all work for the manager. And as I say, they could go throughout the entire league campaign unbeaten. Even if Celtic were at their very best this season, it would be neck and neck.
Right, okay. So Stephen Gerrard's doing a very good job. God, 10 years. I mean, it's a hell of a thing to have to start over again, that 10 in a row.
You know this, I remember back in the bad old days when Rangers were winning 9 titles in a row.
Yeah.
And I never thought in my lifetime that I would see it for Celtic. I never thought I would see Celtic playing in a European final. And I have. I've seen all of these things. I've been there. I was at the games. We've enjoyed a quadruple treble. And it's fine to look back, but we can't rest on our laurels for much longer because, as I say, you know, what happens at Rangers is they win the league, they have an opportunity to access Champions League riches. If that happens, the financial gap will shorten. Mm. Celtic, over the last 10 years, have been weighing ahead the most rich club in the country. If we ever fell into any kind of trouble, we could probably buy ourselves out of it. This season, the capitulation this season has thrown everything out the window along with the kitchen sink. So we really need to act quickly. And I think that's why there are real concerns around this appointment. It is a massive appointment. It's as big as the appointment that we made when Martin O'Neill came in as a manager after the John Barnes and Kenny Dalglish experiment.
A final one for you. What of the Shane Duffy situation then? Your read on Duffy and his performances and the treatment he's received. I mean, his confidence is clearly on the floor. Why has it gone so badly wrong for Shane Duffy? He seemed to start okay.
You know what? Everybody at Celtic were delighted. The fans were delighted. We were crying out for someone of Shane Duffy's ilk. We needed that experience at the back. And I spoke to a pal of mine who's a Brighton fan. And this description kept coming up. He's a no-nonsense defender. Now, Chris Julian and Chris Iyer are ball players. They like to run with the ball. They like to spray passes all over the park. And what we wanted is we wanted someone to come in with the experience of a Shane Duffy. Obviously, the Irish connection. You know, he's captained Ireland. He comes in. He's a Celtic man. And it's been horrible to watch. It's been absolutely horrible to watch. He's simply not performed. He's had personal issues. He's had injuries. And, you know, the likelihood is he'll go back to Brighton in the summer. But the Celtic fans truly wanted that to work out, and it simply has not worked for all parties concerned.
Mm. Yeah, it is a pity. Final one for you, Paul John. Just it's occurring to me, obviously we don't have fans in the stadium now, so you're probably going to have to go back to maybe a year ago or whatever. But you talked there about growing up and watching the Souness era and now into the 2000s. And so you've been around this rivalry with Rangers for a very long time. Is it as toxic, for want of a better word, and hate-filled and sectarian as it's ever been, or has that changed over time?
I don't think it's any better, put it that way. I think what's happened is, you know, both clubs are huge institutions across the world, not just in Scotland. And when, obviously, Rangers were not in the league, Celtic fans enjoyed that. Mm. Now, that's natural. That's football. But as you've just said there, Celtic against Rangers isn't just your normal football banter. It's not just football crack. It goes deeper than that. And when the situation arose where it looked likely that Rangers would actually win the league, the big thing for me is your football fans need to enjoy their own success rather than someone else's demise. But in Glasgow, that doesn't work. That doesn't happen. So they are just as enthused about our downfall as they are about their own success. Mm. It hasn't gone away. You would hope that in generations, the hate and the sectarianism and the bigotry would ease off a bit. You know, we're living in enlightened times now. And let's just hope that when people come out of the end of this pandemic, and we've all had a lot of time to think, you know, we've weighed up what's important in life. It's great to have rivalries, of course it is. But let's just remember what's important in life. And when we get back into those football stadiums, let's remember the hard times we've all been through.
Yeah, well, listen, that's a nice note to finish on, hopefully. Paul John Dykes, author and host of Celtic State of Mind, the podcast. Thanks so much, Paul John. Appreciate it.
Anytime. It was an absolute pleasure.
Cheers. Latest in the Champions League, still nil all between Atalanta and Real Madrid. Manchester City, though, have gone 2-0 up away to Borussia Mönchengladbach. 67 minutes on the clock. Gabriel Jesus with the goal in the last 2 minutes or so. Bernardo Silva with Man City's first in the first half. So Man City 2-0 up away to Borussia Mönchengladbach. 0-0 between Atalanta and Real Madrid. There's a new documentary on Netflix. It's about Pele. So we could only call Tim Vickery.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise. The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
You're welcome back. If you're just tuning in, 2-0 to Manchester City away to Borussia Mönchengladbach, and it's 0-0 between Atalanta and Real Madrid. About 68 minutes gone in those games. Football on Off the Ball with thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie. Now, I mentioned new Pele documentary on Netflix.
I don't think anywhere in the world has been an atmosphere quite like this.
Mas o Brasil é meu país. Significa tudo para mim.
É, foi tudo.
Acho que o grande presente que você ganha na vitória não é a joia, né?
Now, I didn't understand any of that, but Tim Vickery did. How you doing?
I'm very well, John. How are yourself?
Yeah, very well, very well. So you haven't seen this. So I watched the vast bulk of this afternoon. So I'm going to fire some stuff at you and you can give me your response.
Yeah, I'm going to have to get dragged screaming and kicking into the 21st century. What is this Netflix of which you speak? I think my wife and my stepdaughter, I think they do it. So I'll have to get them to kind of line this up for me. But, you know, me, sorry. I wasn't born for these times.
You are already using far more technology speaking to me right now than Netflix.
Well, there you go. I'm interested in this, obviously, for obvious reasons. But one is, it's a kind of project that I flirted with the idea of doing 25 years ago.
I'll bet, yeah.
When Pelé was sports minister. And when he was sports minister, that meant that there was a certain opening there. And he gave an interview where he, at the time, he was involved in changing legislation in Brazil to introduce freedom of contract for players, known as the Pelé Law. And he mentioned in an interview that back in the day when he was Pelé, when he was playing, he could have done more for footballers. He kind of regretted that he didn't do enough. And I thought, hey there, bang, open door. Let's use that as a starting point to try and investigate what he did and what he didn't do and what he could have done. So I tried to set that up as an interview. The Brazilian ministry there, they would only let me do that. They would say, all right, we'll give you an interview, but you've got to go to New York to do it. And at that time, I didn't have money to cross from one side of Rio to the other side of Rio, let alone New York. So, you know, that idea died. And when he stopped being sports minister, it was clear that no one was going to be able to do that kind of thing, you know, because it just goes back to public relations. So the question becomes, I think, Joe Malloy, why has he opened himself up to this line of questioning with this documentary now, which I see took months of negotiation? And I think now, and he is obsessed with his legacy, and he is every entitlement to be obsessed with his legacy. One of the horrible things about being such a public figure is that you don't control your own narrative. You know, other people write your life story for him. And over the last few years, I think a couple of things have happened. And he always was seen as there's a lot of lazy journalism involved in this, even by great journalists. The kind of good guy, bad guy, you know, Pelé, Maradona. And the younger generation haven't bought that. They haven't gone along with that. You know, a lot of the younger generation have really related to Maradona's rebel stance and seen Pelé as a overly conservative figure in a suit. And also the younger generation have tended to be disparaging about what Pelé did on the field. You know, oh yeah, who was that against? So I think Pelé has realised now that in order to have some control over the narrative now and when he's gone, it's in his interest to put himself in a position where some of the harder questions are going to be asked.
Interesting. I mean, there's an opening, various montages, as you might imagine, and then there's an empty chair and you're waiting for Pelé to walk to the chair, presumably to be interviewed, you know? And the striking thing is that, of course, he's coming out with a walking aid. You know, that's what first grabs you. My God, he's very old now. He's in his 80s. So he sits down and they start and...
Well, not only in his 80s, he's also, he just turned 80, but he's also a former footballer who's in his 80s.
Mm.
Sport at that level is not health. No, it's almost the opposite of health. You know, if you think of the battering that his body took during his playing career, he paid a price to be Pelé.
Mm. Well, so, I mean, it features him being interviewed quite a bit. His sister's in it. There's an uncle in it. But that couldn't be right. How could his uncle be in it? Anyway, that can't be right. But there are various teammates in it, former coaches. So there's, you know, he's put out the calls and said, yeah, look, thumbs up for this one. You can partake in this one. I wouldn't say it's warts and all by any means, but certainly he addresses his infidelity. He addresses his children outside of wedlock. Now he doesn't get into it in a great way. He just says, and the question was even, was it very difficult to be faithful with all these women throwing themselves at you? And he says, yes, it was very difficult. And that's a kind of the extent of it. But the other really interesting area they examine, and I don't associate Pelé's career enough with this from the outside, the extent to which his career ran parallel with this unbelievable change in Brazil, i.e. the 50s was, you know, a pretty exciting time into the early 60s when he emerges, obviously, in 57 at Santos and then 58 at the World Cup, and then into the early 60s where he's at his absolute peak and it's phenomenal. And then the military coup happens. And that's where it gets really interesting. And the extent to which his career runs in tandem with the early days of this dictatorship. So 64, the military coup happens. 68, things get worse again. Institutional Act 5 is what it's called. You'll know all about that, I'm sure. Government tools to secure order and peace. So they took away every freedom you could imagine. Arrest without due cause. People simply disappeared. Pelé at the time, and even now, said, life didn't change that much for me. But General Medici, the cruelest dictator Brazil ever had, is what it said in the documentary, loves football as well. And, you know, in 1969, for instance, when Pelé scores his mythical 1,000th goal, 3 days later, he flies to Brasilia and has a very public sit-down with Medici, and they hug and they have coffee. And, you know, and you can imagine a lot of the way it's edited, it shows Pelé scoring goals and then dead people being carried through the streets and horrible violence. You know, it's cut back to back. The message is pretty clear. And I guess here's the question. They do address in the documentary the sense that Pelé wasn't just politically neutral. It's that he was submissive, you know, and people close to him are critical of him. And, you know, the parallels are drawn with Ali. Equally, somebody else in the documentary says, well, Ali, you know, he was giving up things, sure, but he wasn't at risk of torture and maybe death. You know, this was a dictatorship. And what Pelé says now is, look, I'm not superhuman. It was a dictatorship. What did you want me to do? I was a footballer. I was one person, but it was a dictatorship. So there wasn't much I could do. It's really interesting that they went there. This is very much a political film as much as a Pelé film. It's about how great Brazil seemed to be in the 50s, early 60s, birth of a modern nation, exciting, fun. Brazil come from nowhere, win World Cups. That's part of the story. And then, boom, this tragic dictatorship is born and Pelé's place in it all. So that's quite a long, it's not even a question, but that's to give you a sense of and the listeners, of how this documentary goes about the Pelé story. It's not just football, 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 here's another goal.
Yeah, I mean, a number of things to come out of that, I think. And the big one is people are looking for too much from a sports star if they think that he's responsible for saving the nation from dictatorship. Also, I mean, the military dictatorship is a controversial era. And the current Brazilian president, who was elected democratically, idolizes it. There are some on the right, even inside the government, who claim that the term military dictatorship is false. The military had presidents, but the institutions, Congress and so on, were operating. Now, anyone who disagreed with them was removed from the political process. So that's not a line that I take. But that military dictatorship, it did have mass support. Much is made of a march of students towards the end of the decade that was a march of 100,000. Well, at the time of the military coup in 64, that the right wing, the pro-God family thing, they could put a million out on the streets. And so that there was mass support for this regime. And during the 60s, Brazil was undergoing what was seen at the time as an economic miracle, which buttressed the support of that regime for a considerable amount of time. Things start going wrong in the early 70s, both because the international situation becomes less favorable, but also because that economic miracle, it cannot be sustained because it concentrates wealth too much. But for a while, a lot of people aren't doing badly. It's not a military dictatorship, which is really comparable to what happened in Argentina and Chile a few years later.
Right.
When, you know, in Argentina, 30,000 people died and disappeared. In Brazil, it was maybe 3,000.
Right.
And Chile, the Argentina and Chile things are brutal suppression of working class organizations. Much of the line of conflict in the Brazilian military dictatorship is between the dictatorship and middle class intellectuals. That's where a lot of the fault right. line is. Now, that's not a debate that involves Pelé. He hasn't grown up around middle-class intellectuals discussing political ideas. He's criticized in the film by Paulo César Caju, his teammate from 1970, who's a terrific figure, was a great player, and is a great figure. But there are key differences between them. Caju is 10 years younger. So, you know, he's grown up with the social movements in the United States in the 60s as an important, and Pelé is formed as a person before that has happened. But Caju is also, he's from the favelas of Rio, which, because of the topography of Rio, they're right close to some of the middle class areas. And Caju gets in with the middle class intelligentsia, and with them he forms a perspective on the world. Now, Pelé never had that perspective on the world. He never had that kind of countercultural thing. These kind of regimes, authoritarian regimes, and this is not the first time this happened in Brazil. I mean, the dictatorship of Getúlio Vargas, who is the founder of the modern nation, really, came to power in 1930, was president with one interruption until 54, both democratically elected, and at times kind of stages his own coup and his kind of Mussolini style, relatively benign, non-militaristic tropical fascism. That's right in the tradition of Brazil. I think it's important to make these points. I mean,
The film definitely oversimplifies that then, because I was watching it and there was a sense of like, geez, 50s booming, 60s, early 60s, Pelé at his peak, looks like a lot of fun. And then like this evil takes over and it's death everywhere. It was akin to what I thought, you say it's not like the Argentinian dictatorship. No. It's kind of presented that way, I would say, and like this was just unequivocally horrific in every single way. And
That's a huge simplification. Okay. There. I mean, I'm clearly, by every inclination, I am totally opposed to the military government. There is a difference, I think, between them and the lot who are in power now, is that at least the military government at the start, they did have a project. So they had some project to develop the country. It wasn't just dreams of privatizing everyone. And now I just can't see what they have to offer at all, apart from trying to flexibilize and increase access to weapons for the population. There was some kind of project that they had in 64 for developing the country. It was wrong-headed, and the big phrase at the time was, let's make the cake first and then distribute it later. It doesn't work like that. Yeah. That doesn't work. Part of making the cake is distributing it, because then you have with more distribution of income, you have an economy that is sustainable. There were all sorts of brutalities taking place in the dictatorship, but a lot of working class Brazilians, not politicized working class Brazilians, would look back on the late 60s as a happy age. I mean, 70 is so important. The 70 World Cup is so important because it's the first time that it was on TV live in Brazil. And more people have TVs. You know, TV ownership has just gone whoosh. Mm. So, you know, there are people buying these things. So it can be oversimplified, that era, and I think the contrast with Ali is interesting, because you don't see the collective greatness of an Ali in Pelé. But then again, Pelé comes from a very individualist society, a very kind of every man from himself type of society, and in the case of Ali, the lines are so clear cut, aren't they? Mm. Who is black and who is white, and who is doing what to who? Who is lynching who? Who is denying the right to vote to who? You know, it's so clear to identify who is black and who is white. Mm. And which side are you on? And then throw in that, there's the Vietnam War, where, you know, young blacks are being sent to die thousands of miles away from home. Now but that's not the context that Pelé is in. Mm. The lines are really not anything like as clear. So, you know, Pelé is dealing with an authoritarian reality that the vast majority just went along with. Mm. As I say, the conflict is more with middle class intellectuals. That's much more in Brazil than is the case in Argentina and Chile, where a concerted attempt is made to break working class associations.
Okay. This focuses on kind of 58 to 70. It's his World Cup years, really. Like, it doesn't get into the Pelé I grew up with, which was a guy who was just hoovering up every advertisement he could do.
And, I'm surprised it doesn't go into 74. And I'll tell you why.
Go on.
I mean, 74 is crucial in this whole narrative about the military dictatorship. because he didn't play 74. Mm. His last competitive games were for Brazil with a 70 World Cup. He played a few friendlies afterwards and then bowed out. They were desperate for him to play 74. There were all kinds of appeals made for him to play in 74, and he didn't do it. Now, from a distance, when at a time when the military dictatorship was seen as a bad thing, Pelé then said that he'd never said at the time, he said, "I didn't play the World Cup in 74 as a protest against the military dictatorship." This is, I think, the kind of cynical side of Pelé, because if this was a protest, he certainly didn't make any protest at the time.
Yeah.
None at all.
Yeah.
So what's the point? If you're going to protest and no one knows you're protesting, yeah, what's the point?
Yeah.
But also, I don't think the claim is a reasonable one. I went in depth with this a few years ago, in depth interviews with Mario Zagallo, who was the coach in 70 and in 74, and Tostão, who was the centre forward in the 70 team, the brightest fella he ever played football with. Tostão said, no, it's got nothing to do with military dictatorship. It's all about the fact that he wanted to control his own narrative, and he left the stage at the best possible way that he could leave the stage in 70. Because going into the 70 World Cup, this is something which has conveniently been forgotten by many, there was a strong lobby that didn't want him to be in the team. That thought he should be dropped. So in 70 is really his act of revenge, it's where he wanted to leave the stage. Zagallo, who was the coach who really wanted him to be in the team, Zagallo said no. It was all about money. He'd signed his contract with an American multinational, and he could make more money doing that than he could. Playing for Brazil in the World Cup. Now, both, I think, are true. Part of Pelé and part of the unbelievable genius of Pelé, the footballer, is I think there is the perfect synthesis in there. There's a perfect synthesis of his two parents, of his father and his mother, in that the two motivating forces in life are pride and fear. And he has these very, very strongly from both of his parents. His dad, who's a great footballer, easygoing, lovely smile, but immense pride in being a footballer, immense pride. And you see that in Pelé. Pelé is immensely proud of his profession. His mother is a very, very strong character at a time when for married women in Brazil, there were no outlets for that. You know, you're a housewife. There's nothing really you can do. And so that strength of her character, that becomes fear, the fear of being unable to provide. And he had a very precarious childhood, especially when his father on his big day suffers a serious injury. And that ends the family's dreams of social advancement. It means his dad is cleaning the doctor's surgery and so on. And Pelé's a shoeshine boy. And there is no way that his mother wants him to be a footballer. And he has to overcome really strong maternal resistance to the idea of becoming a footballer. But that fear of poverty, I think he will go to his grave not feeling financially secure, which is a terrible thing. But that's what child poverty does to people. It really leaves a mark. But in his case, that fear drove him. And you're watching Pelé. When you're watching Pelé, you're looking at someone who, in terms of physical preparation, is 30 years ahead of his time. You're looking at someone at his best. He looks like a different species from his opponents.
Yeah.
And not only is he unbelievably athletically gifted, but he's also really intelligent, really cool, and driven. And part of this drive is the fear of being poor, the fear of going back to poverty. And at a time when some of the biggest names in Brazilian football are signing blank contracts and letting the club fill out the terms later, you know, he's got himself agents for negotiating, and he's got his eye on the bottom line all of the time, you know. So there is a huge price. It's not only the walking with a frame. There's a psychological price that he paid to achieve the level of incredible excellence that he achieved.
Well, that's fascinating. I didn't get much of that in the documentary. It's a bit damning, which is maybe a pity. It's a bit less nuanced, I think, than what you've given us, and that's a pity, because there's still
I've spent a lot of time thinking about
him. Yeah, there's still a really interesting
documentary there about him. Because I think journalism in general has done this so badly. And even the greatest of all time for me with a pen or with a typewriter, Hugh McIlvany, the Scottish writer, is my inspiration in so many ways. No one better in a British context, I think, at putting sport into the context of society. But even some of the stuff that he wrote about Pelé is just hagiography. You know, how great he is. Everything about him is great. And there's a human being in there with human flaws. I mean, I can't see anything wrong in his infidelities, to be honest. I mean, I have no moral perspective on that whatsoever.
No.
But the way that he treated at least one of his daughters born out of wedlock is deplorable. Right. You know, if you bring someone into the world, you have to take responsibility for that, and you can't always do it on your terms, which is what he wants to do. And she had a political career pushing for responsibilities of fathers to be enshrined in law. So he wasn't perfect. He wasn't a saint. He couldn't have been to be as good as he was, because you don't get that good at anything without an almost insane level of drive and ambition. That's probably, there are levels of that just simply aren't healthy.
Yeah. Well, geez, that's a documentary. That's the 10-part series. You need to get on Netflix. You need to watch this thing, and then you need to call Netflix and make the pitch, because there's something maybe more interesting there. Here's one last observation, and I have 2 minutes tops, so I'll be quick and you talk. I had two thoughts watching the football footage. One, geez, these goals and some of these bits I haven't seen. God, they're better than I thought. You know, God, they're really, really good. And secondly, his highlights reel, probably a victim of his time, still isn't as good as Maradona's, and still isn't as good as Messi's and Ronaldo's, for obvious reasons. He's a victim of that, I suspect.
Yeah, perhaps. And I think he's weakened his own position, and his followers, his fans have weakened his position by harping on about 1,000 goals.
Yeah.
Because it's a rubbish argument. It's so weak, you know, because greatness is not about statistical accumulation, and it certainly isn't about goals scored in friendlies, however good the opposition. The greatness of Pelé is the big games, and you know the big stuff. He's almost always coming through every time on the big stage when it really, really matters. And it's a great shame that the home and away intercontinental thing between the champions of Europe and South America, it's a great shame that that fell into discredit, because when it started, it was fantastic. Had there been TV then, that would have become one of the game's main events, you know, like having a World Cup every year, home and away. Because him against Benfica in 62, it's the greatest game of his career. Santos have won the first leg in Brazil 3-2. Benfica are favourites back in Lisbon to win it. And Pelé puts away from home, he puts Santos 5-0 up. With a combination of either scoring or making goals, and he's just charging through a fantastic Benfica defence as if he's like Brian Glover in Kez playing against kids. It's like watching someone from another species. And if you want to see what Pelé was all about, that was a huge, huge game, the biggest club game he ever played. Watch him in it and marvel.
Yeah, I'm probably doing him a disservice there. Tim Vickery, thanks so much.
My pleasure, thank you.
Latest in the Champions League, Man City 2-0 up away to Borussia Mönchengladbach, Atalanta 0, Real Madrid 0. Back in a sec.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise. The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
The OTB Podcast Network. With Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural protein-powered chicken bites.